Slate's coverage of food systems is made possible in part by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Welcome to Slate's Table to Farm. I'm Laura Anderson, Slate's food and drink editor. And joining me here in New York is Dan Pashman, the host of the Sporkful Food Podcast. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Laura.
Each week in this podcast, we start at our table, we choose a particular food, and we try to figure out where it comes from. And finally, we cook it and eat it. Today, we are very excited to be talking about bread. Now, Dan, you are a very accomplished home cook, but you're not a big baker. Is that right?
That's right. Well, I really don't like to follow recipes. I like to make things up as I go along. And so I'm very intimidated by baking because I feel like it's more precise. There's a lot of science involved, especially bread baking. And it's not the kind of thing that you can just tinker with as you go and, oh, wait, at the last minute it needs a little more of this or that. It's sort of like, you know, once you put that thing in the oven, the die is cast. And so I'm just I'm intimidated by it.
So I enjoy baking. I don't do it these days as much as I used to, but I did go through a phase because baking has such a reputation for being really persnickety and detail-oriented. I went through a phase of making bread without using a recipe. I would just, like, throw a bunch of flour in a bowl, add some salt and some yeast, and then just, like, you know, add water without measuring anything.
You were, like, a rogue baker.
I was a rogue baker, and, like, it always turned out fine, but it was never, like, amazing bread. So I think that's probably the reason I stopped doing that. But I do believe that yeast bread, requires less attention to detail than, say, making cookies or cake or something like that.
Really?
Well, this is just my personal opinion. Okay. I don't know if a professional baker would agree with that. And speaking of which, we're actually later in the show going to be talking to a professional baker. But joining us now from Walla Walla, Washington, to talk about the history of bread and why people like the kinds of breads that they do is Aaron Bobrow-Strain. Aaron is an associate professor of politics at Whitman College, and he's the author of White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. Aaron, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
So I guess our first question sounds kind of basic and maybe kind of stupid, but what exactly is white bread? What makes white bread different from other kinds of bread?
There's all kinds of white bread. White bread is anything that's bread and made from a refined wheat flour. But really what I'm talking about, bread that has gone through the industrial process of essentially taming the living, unruly nature of bread to a factory assembly line. Bread makers had to make bread faster, right? Because the old way of making bread involved having large quantities of dough just sitting around on the shop floor doing, quote-unquote, nothing, i.e. fermenting and rising. But they were just taking up space on the factory floor. So a whole series of mechanical engineering solutions to help dough rise faster, temperature control and mixing techniques, as also the creation of additives, particularly yeast nutrients that are basically like putting yeast on meth, can speed up the rate of fermentation.
Meth bread.
Meth bread, exactly.
But just so I understand, isn't there something even more elemental about white bread? Like when they split the wheat germ, that the flour that makes white flour? I mean, isn't it something – forgetting the industrialization for a minute. I mean, isn't there something even more elemental that makes it white?
Yeah, and that's the splitting off of the germ and keeping the white interior of the wheat grain.
So when we hear the term whole grain bread – that means that the germ has not been split off and discarded.
Mostly true, yeah. But most white flours will still contain a small percentage of the germ and outer coatings of the wheat kernel.
So the way that you describe the challenges that industrial bakers had to overcome in order to turn bread into an industrial commodity, it sounds kind of ridiculous that anyone ever thought that that would be a good idea, given how volatile bread is. And also, I think if you would just ask anyone to do a blind taste test between an industrial loaf, like a piece of Wonder Bread, and a freshly baked, you know, baguette, I feel like most people would go for the baguette because it just tastes better. So can you talk about why anyone thought it was a good idea to industrialize bread in the first place?
Yeah, and it's actually because of those challenges and obstacles, bread was relatively late in terms of when it industrialized compared to other important foods. But I think you have to put yourself back in the mindset of a time when the country got 30% of its daily calories on average from bread. And today, no food provides 30% of our daily calorie intake. So this was an incredibly crucial food. And if you could, as the Ward Baking Company of New York almost did in the late 1920s, corner the entire market on bread in the United States, you would have an enormous political and economic power.
So does that mean that for a while in the early 20th century, once the Ward Bakery had sort of cornered the market, that there weren't really corner bakeries, local independent bakeries making the kind of fresh bread that people seem to enjoy today?
Yeah, by 1930s, we start to see the destruction of those corner bakeries. And what's interesting is that it turns out that, you know, we see that as a tragedy. And, you know, how could we have lost that real, authentic bread that our great-grandparents must have enjoyed? But in the day, it was seen in some ways as a life-saving thing, because this was a moment when Americans, especially middle-class, native-born Americans, were deeply anxious about their food, were worried about food contamination, were worried about other things like immigration. And they associated those small neighborhood bakeries with swarthy, dark, scary new immigrants from Southern Europe and Eastern Europe. And so there was this idea that small local bakeries were dangerous places. And the big factory bread, you know, white loaves coming out of these shining white ultra-modern factories were seen as a kind of a life-saving refuge from the dangers of a time of great upheaval.
But am I right, Aaron? I mean, that notion wasn't just planted into people's heads by magic or through word of mouth. The large companies, Ward Bakery in particular, Ward Bakery went on to be Wonder Bread. They helped to press that idea into people's heads.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, by the late 1920s, the number one slogan bread companies are using is not something like "tastes great" or "fresh" or "just like mother's." The number one slogan was "untouched by human hands."
It kind of mimics the story of, we made reference to this last week on our podcast, the story of lard, where Procter & Gamble decided they had all this the process of hydrogenation was invented. They had all this oil left over after electricity had been invented, and they had to do something with it. And so Crisco was invented, and they started talking about how lard was dirty. And Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, helped to implant in people's minds the idea that it was dirty, and lard fell out of favor. It sounds like a similar thing happened with bread. And the new white bread, the new thing, became – back at that time, the high class alternative, you know. And I think actually, Laura, you were talking, we were getting ready to talk to Aaron about something interesting that a professor of yours had said.
Yeah. So when I was in college, this professor of mine in college, and I'm paraphrasing, has described history as being a series of phases in which rich women would eat white bread while poor women would breastfeed, and then they switched. And rich women would breastfeed and eat whole grain bread while poor women eat white bread. So can you talk a little bit more about the class implications of white bread versus whole grain bread?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how your analogy is exactly right, both with lard and with breastfeeding. And what's interesting is that with bread, we see a constant struggle over this. Even as industrial white bread really gets stabilized as this utopian vision of responsibility, of national progress, of good health. Immediately, there are food gurus and diet experts who are contesting that and saying, no, actually, this stuff is too modern. It's causing everything from tuberculosis to criminal insanity and making us fat, dumb, and lazy.
How did we get from the golden age of Wonder Bread to where we are now, where Wonder Bread is seen as a source of empty calories? It kind of has working class connotations, and anyone who can afford better bread, quote unquote, better bread, will buy a not industrialized bread, but maybe freshly baked bread, or maybe they'll make their own bread. So how did we get from the 1950s to today?
Yeah, that switch really has its roots in the trajectory from hippie to yuppie. With the 1960s counterculture, we have this sense that eating homemade bread, eating whole wheat bread, is a form of collective rebellion against an oppressive establishment, right? It's about fighting the man. You know, Beatrice Thrum Hunter, for example, who was an influential Whole Foods advocate of the time, said that baking your own whole wheat bread is an act of revolt against the mechanization of life. But by the 1970s, industrial bakers realize that they can capitalize on this aura of youthful health and rebellion, and actually turn health and whole wheat breads into their most dynamic sector. There was a baker I saw quoted from this period who said, you know, now we can sell Cadillacs, not just Fords.
So let me ask you this, Aaron. When you go bread shopping today, let's say, maybe this never happens to you, but let's say you're in a pinch and you're not near your local bakery and you're out of yeast at home and you need some bread and you happen to be at the supermarket and you end up in that aisle, what do you buy?
I'm a kind of geeky home baker, so end up making my bread a lot, but I definitely have found myself in that pinch all the time. And, you know, I'm going to go with the closest thing to an artisanal bread or a whole wheat health bread, but really I'm not all that interested in kind of judging and moralizing about people's bread choices. I think a big point of the book is that when food movements, all those diet gurus and health experts we talked about, get so focused on moralizing and judging people's food choices at the supermarket, they often miss the deeper root causes, like economic inequality and concentration in the food system.
So getting back to you as an eater and as a bread baker, can you just talk to us about how you make bread and what your bread making technique secrets are?
You know, I'm a geeky amateur bread baker. I wouldn't even say I'm very good at it, but my staple is a French country bread, a Levain that's partially white flour and partially a little bit of rye and a little bit of whole wheat, with a long, slow fermentation. I mean, I think that the key thing in terms of making good bread is to rebel against those two principles we started off with, which were the faster and stronger doughs. So I go for the slowest fermentation I can, because that's going to develop the most flavor in your dough. It tends to be a much more delicate, more finicky kind of dough as a result.
Well, we already had an apple nerd on our podcast a few weeks ago. Now we can add bread geek to our list of guests.
Of food dorks. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it was fun. Thank you.
Aaron Bobrow-Strain is an associate professor of politics at Whitman College and the author of White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf.
Well, Laura, I'm really struck by Aaron's comments regarding sort of the trends of bread and the other similar types of trends that we related it to. And I just have to wonder, you know, here we are. We assume that we're right. History bends toward us and that we must be making progress and that the bread we're making today is an improvement on whatever generations past made.
The best possible bread of all possible worlds.
That's right. But the truth is that, like, I feel like from what Aaron said that my kids are going to be like, Dad, how could you eat this gross whole grain bread? It's all dirty. Look at this white bread loaf that gets produced by my Google glasses. You know, like it just drops an injection of bread into my bloodstream, and it's so much more convenient. And I can eat on the go, and it tastes delicious.
Right. Well, I mean, the point you're making is that taste is very much tied to one's background and one's culture and one's time. But sure, it's definitely conceivable to me, especially after listening to Aaron talk about what people were thinking about bread just 50, 60 years ago, that in 50 years, people will think that our, you know, flour-covered, super crusty, airy, artisanal bread is just kind of stupid and lame.
Right. Although I do think we should distinguish between sort of the large, slow-moving trends and fads, like Atkins diet or the gluten-free thing, which I think is a fad. And I keep thinking as we're having this conversation about this Lewis Black routine on The Daily Show, which I looked it up. It's actually now 10 years old. And he's talking about the Atkins diet and bread, and this is what he says.
One of the most popular is Atkins, the low-carb, high-stupidity diet made famous by celebrities like Sarah Jessica Parker and Julia Roberts. But now the baking industry is blaming the Atkins fad for a 15% drop in sales, since Atkins says the worst food you could ever eat is bread. Bread? Turns out we've all been eating the wrong thing. since the dawn of civilization.
I still quote that all the time. I mean, it's like, really, people? You know, I just think we all need to take a little bit of a step back.
Well, it just goes to show what a completely volatile and unrooted food culture we have in America, right? But it seems like for those of us who are not going gluten-free, the trends in bread are moving back towards European-style, old-fashioned, artisanal loaves. So we decided, because we wanted to talk more about how those loaves are produced, to call up Amy Sherber, who is the owner and founder of Amy's Bread, a very successful chain of New York bakeries that specialize in traditional European-style bread and other delicious baked goods. Amy, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thank you. So let's start talking about flour. I think a lot of people who bake bread or who buy bread have no idea where their flour comes from, and they also might think that it doesn't really matter. Is that perception true, or does it matter where flour comes from?
Flour matters completely. That is one of the most important ingredients. That's the main ingredient in your bread, so you need to know where it came from and what kind of flour is the best for the type of bread you're making. You know, if you're making a flour that's got a big, chewy crumb, you want something, a bread flour, or you might want an organic flour or a whole grain flour. So the type of flour is critical.
And where do you source your flour from?
Well, when I first started, I was sort of at the mercy of whatever suppliers would deliver to me because Manhattan wasn't so great on variety. But over time, because of so many people, bakers like me, making beautiful breads with really great quality, the flour suppliers came out of the woodwork. And so now I have the opportunity to buy flour. I buy flour that's milled in Utah that's really beautiful from this organic mill that I know some nice bakeries in California also use. Sounds like it's from far away, but flour generally is from sort of the middle of the country. But I also choose King Arthur flour, which is a great flour from Vermont. And that flour is very natural. It's unbleached, unbromated, and it's really reliable. And then we also use a New York State flour, so we've gotten to be much more local with our flour now, which is kind of a fun thing. We get a flour from upstate New York from North Country Farms, and we have a beautiful, really nice whole wheat flour that gives you a great aroma when you mix with it, and it's been one of our favorite new things we've done this year.
Is there any way to tell how good flour is other than by baking with it?
Well, you know, the thing about flour is that you open the bag and you look in it and it looks like white powder. You don't really know what you've got until you've tried it. And you can read about it. You can meet people and hear what they tell you about the flour. But the real way of knowing is by trying it yourself and by making something, a recipe that you recognize, you know how it should come out, and trying flour in it.
I know that you trained in France, and I was wondering why France is known for having such amazing bread. Does it mostly come down to the flour, or do they just employ different techniques in France?
You know, I think it's in part due to the cultural interest in good bread. It's such an important part of the daily life in France, and the people that are bakers have to go through a 2-year apprenticeship program in these baking schools that are very stringent. They have, you know, incredible training and discipline, and with that tradition, people then have a lot more knowledge about what happens with different kinds of flour and different kinds of fermentation. And that knowledge, you know, they have history, they have a lot of theories, and I think that's why I wanted to learn about French baking, because there was much more information to be learned.
Did you go through a program like that?
Well, I went to France and worked in some bakeries for a short time in each one, and just observed what they do mainly. But then I went back as part of the Bread Baker's Guild to this intensive training at a baking school in France, just for 1 week. But it was amazing because we had one of the master bakers giving us all his secrets and techniques, and we learned so much in that time.
Is there a specific moment or anecdote you can remember from that when you were like, wow, this is on a whole other level?
Yeah, I mean, everything we watched was tremendous, but the way that he worked with his hands was so different, and his knowledge, his hands were just so gifted at working with bread dough, and his technique was very gentle, and I think a lot of bakers that I knew had been using a lot of force with their bread dough, and you even use the word like punch down in recipes, which we don't do. We don't slam our hands in the dough, but, you know, we watched how gently he treated the dough, and this was this amazing moment of saying, wow, that's how you take care of dough. This is a very different style, and just the skill, his fingers working, was inspirational.
That's a fascinating point, which actually applies to a question that I wanted to ask, because we just spoke to this historian, Aaron Bob Rowe Strain, who has written about the history of industrialized bread in America. And during the peak of industrialized bread, the most popular slogan for, you know, Wonder Bread and that kind of bagged, white, soft, squishy bread was untouched by human hands. People did not want, at the time, bread that had been touched by people. Can you talk
a little bit?
Which
is shocking. That's just so shocking because, I mean, making it by hand is the best possibility for us. That's what we're very proud of doing. We don't use any machines. So,
could you talk a little bit about why using your hands is important?
I will. When you take a batch of dough, let's say you're making white dough, and you mix it up in a mixer, if you mix it less, you keep all the enzymes and the nice pigments in the dough, especially if you use unbleached flour. So you keep the natural essence of the wheat. And then if you divide it into a piece and then you shape it into a loaf by hand, your hands are very gentle and you maintain all the holes and air bubbles in the dough. So you have big, nice holes and a beautiful structure to the bread. But if you put it in a machine, if you, first of all, mix it in a machine for a long time, it whitens up the dough and it starts to lose that beautiful creamy color. It starts to lose some of the smell. When you crack open the bread, you don't smell much. And then you lose some of the flavor. And then it sort of looks like Wonder Bread. And it loses all the characters of the wheat. You've lost all the nutrition and the aroma. You lose the point, in a way. So then you have to add stabilizers and these weird flavors and additives to make it taste sort of like it should have tasted if you hadn't overworked it. But it doesn't really ever come out to be the same as a natural bread that you just worked with by very little handling. So, you know, hands are very gentle and much different than a machine.
So, Amy, I'm not a huge amateur baker. I bake occasionally. And, you know, homemade bread is great, but I've never made a loaf as good as the loaves that I buy at Amy's or at other professional bakeries. Can you talk about the techniques that professional bakers use that result in such high-quality bread and whether amateur bakers can apply those at home?
Yeah, I think one of the big differences is the type of ovens that we have. We're able to get a great crust on our bread, and the crust is... it can be browned differently, and then we have steam in our ovens, which adds a lot of great crunchiness to the crust, a gloss, a golden brown color that you can't get very easily in a bread in an oven that's not a commercial oven. So I think that's the hardest thing to make it, you know, try to duplicate. But also, you know, just the technique that we have, as I mentioned, I have starters that I use in the dough, and I have my employees help me mix them at the right time of day so they're perfectly fermented so that they can be a wonderful addition to the bread. They add aroma, they add flavor, and we understand fermentation, whereas at home it's hard to make everything exactly the right timing and get those starters to be perfect. So I think I don't want to discourage home bakers. I think it's a great thing to learn because you actually get the sense for what the dough should feel like, and all that's really important. But it isn't quite the same as buying a crusty loaf from a bakery.
Amy, I'm sure you have seen the rash of gluten-free products that have hit the market. It seems like lately anyone with a perpetually upset stomach has decided that gluten must be the problem. And I'm curious what your take on gluten-free bread products is.
You know, I think there's a big interest in that because people are finding that they want to find some other, you know, wheat is sort of tucked into a lot of things, and so it's true that, and flour, and they may feel better not eating a lot of that. I mean, there are lots of diets that come and go, and trends that come and go. Some people are truly get sick from flour or from wheat and gluten. I think it is a passing trend to some extent, although, you know, there's a marketplace for it. You know, we have flour floating around in here, so I can't ever make a completely gluten-free product for those people that have a severe allergy to it. So I feel like, I mean, I'm glad that some people are making those products because there's a market out there. I think it'll come and go. I think there'll be, you know, out of all the people that want to have gluten-free, you know, there'll be the group that really has to go gluten-free, and the rest will maybe slightly go back to gluten after a while because it's hard to give it up. The texture and flavor are not quite the same.
Amy, every week in this show, Dan and I make a recipe, and then we share it with our listeners. And we were wondering if we might use a recipe from the Amy's Bread Cookbook this week.
Oh, sure. That would be great.
Do you have any particular favorites from that cookbook?
You know, I just was doing a demo recently about brunch, and one of the recipes I made was our focaccia recipe, and I think that's a good one to make at home because you bake it in a sheet pan, and the bread comes out great even if you don't have a steam-injected oven, like I was mentioning how hard it is to make a crusty loaf. The focaccia is delicious. It comes out really well, and it's easy to stretch on the pan, and it's fun to have. It's a great weekend bread. You make it, you know, you dip it in olive oil. I actually took a piece of the focaccia dough as I was doing it, and I put chocolate on top, and I baked chocolate in it, so we had some of that for dessert. You can use it as a little canvas for some you know, tomatoes or something to make a little pizza type thing out of it too. But you can do lots of stuff with your dough, and it tastes great. And it's a really easy recipe. It has a biga starter, so you have to make that the night before. It takes 1 minute to make biga. Really, honestly, it's so easy, and it makes your dough really nice and stretchy and moist and delicious. So I would do that.
That sounds great. Now I want to eat focaccia. One of my favorite things about making focaccia is that you poke little indentations in the top of the loaf. Is that correct practice? Because that's always
absolutely
my favorite part.
You poke them, and then you can add a little bit of olive oil on top, and that pools up in there, and it makes it nice and rich and tastes so great. Yep. Very, very important part of the technique, yes.
Mm. All right, Laura, I'm ready to eat focaccia, too.
Me, too.
Good, all right.
Thank you so much for joining us, Amy.
You're welcome.
Amy Sherber is the owner and founder of Amy's Bread, a New York chain of bakeries, and she's also the author of the cookbook called Amy's Bread. Dan, what I love about focaccia is that it has a lot of olive oil in it, and you can absolutely taste the olive oil. It just gives this amazing richness to the crumb and this incredible olive oil flavor, which I wish more breads contained.
Yeah, olive oil plus bread equals good. And I just keep coming back to the point, you know, you asked Aaron at the outset sort of why in their right mind would anyone think that Wonder Bread is better than quality
this.
Fresh than this, exactly. And you and I don't think it is, and Amy doesn't think it is, and Aaron doesn't think it is, and I think most of our listeners don't think it is, but people may be pointing and laughing at us in a few years.
Taste is so subjective. I think that's why these issues tend to be really emotional for people, because people like what they grew up eating.
Yes, but I think there's a difference between trends in taste and trends in what is perceived to be objectively better.
I think you're right that there is definitely a difference between objective quality of food and taste. But what's so interesting is I think in the past 10 years, you know, because of Michael Pollan and the rise of people who are interested in where their food comes from, there's this idea that those two things are one and the same.
I actually now I'm thinking, if I may contradict everything I've said up to this point, that perhaps it's not. Perhaps it's not as Aaron suggests that these things just ebb and flow over time. It's more that there was roughly a way that things were done up until the time of industrialization. And so it's more that the industrial century is an aberration as opposed to there being these ebbs and flows throughout time.
Well, that's the Michael Pollan argument, right? Like, don't eat anything that your grandmother wouldn't recognize as a food. You know, that industrialization is the root of all of our food-related ills.
But I'll tell you one other thing, which is that when you dip bread in olive oil, that is
objectively good.
Right. And it always has been and it always will be.
Exactly.
Even if you're eating it through Google Glasses.
It is an eternal fact.
Yeah.
I think that just about does it for us this week. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Laura.
Dan's food podcast is called The Sporkful, which you can find on iTunes or at sporkful.com. You can also get Amy Sherber's recipe for focaccia on our show page, slate.com/tabletofarm. Join us next week for our final episode of this run.
Cheer.
I know it's very sad, but thankfully we will be talking about a very rich and delicious subject, which is to say dairy and more specifically cheese.
We're actually going to melt the episode and eat it. That's going to be the finale of this series.
I think cheese is the other eternal fact of the universe, which is that it is always delicious and actually would be really delicious right now with this focaccia.
Well, I had Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on The Sporkful a couple of weeks ago, and he actually argued against melted cheese in many situations. He cited a profanity-laced Courtney Love tirade as his reason.
Isn't she feels like cheese is the only reason that people are fat. Wasn't that part of her
tirade? Pretty much. Stop melting cheese on everything because that's what makes you so bleeping fat.
Okay, I will never stop melting cheese on anything. Courtney Love, you are completely wrong on this issue.
Oh, snap.
I know, I'm really good at trash talking, aren't I?
Yeah.